Welcome to the Inside Songwriting Podcast. This is where songwriters find inspiration every time. Hello and welcome back to the Inside Songwriting Podcast. This is episode 15. And believe it or not, this is the third time I've tried to record this intro. I had all kinds of issues with my digital interface. I've just switched to Logic Pro 10, and I won't bore you with the details, but maybe I can answer any questions you have on things like M-boxes and Mackie Onyx satellite firewire interfaces, or even on the beautiful new Focusrite Scarlett 212 that I'm using for this recording. Otherwise, I would have been here with you sooner if not for some issues with all those three things. This is a great conversation I've got coming up. A couple of days ago, I recorded a chat with Michael Roberts. He's my friend and mentor and record producer and musicologist and, more recently, author. And I don't say that lightly. He's written three books recently on songwriting and others related to songwriting. And they're so inspirational. And he is just a brilliant man. And he's starting to share his knowledge and his thoughts and his insights on the craft of songwriting. So I've broken this episode up into two parts, this chat up into two parts, because there's so much valuable information that he shares here. And I just know it's going to resonate with you. I consider the targets of listener for my podcast to be very similar to myself. Saying that, you know, I think that the things that we talk about on this podcast are for all levels of songwriters. But what I mean by being someone like myself that might be listening to this, as in you, is that I'm a person that's always seeking inspiration for songs. I'm a person who lives and breathes songwriting and who thinks about it a lot. To be honest, endlessly, maybe too much, maybe to my detriment, but it's a beautiful thing to be focused on your craft and to be focused on your artistic output, your expression, your sincere expression. And on Inside Songwriting, that's what I'm trying to do, is just give as much of that out on the show so that you'll go away and just be busting to write a song. Now, with this chat with Michael, I would actually have a pen and paper handy. You're going to learn lots, and I'll be sharing the links for the things that he talks about on the show notes. So you can find the show notes for these episodes at insidesongwriting.com and just click on the menu on podcast. So this is episode 15. I'm going to cut right to the interview with Michael now, and I know you're going to enjoy, so here goes. So welcome back to the Inside Songwriting Podcast, Michael Roberts.
Thanks for having me, Carl Brody. Good to be back.
It must be a couple of months since we had you on the show for a great conversation about all things songwriting. And I happen to know what you've been up to mostly, but I wanted to bring you on here so we can talk to you and you can share with us what you've been up to in your own words. And I believe you've been scribbling.
Madly scribbling, as you would well know. We've launched a bit of a publishing endeavor together, which has been very promising and very fruitful so far. So yeah, I think we'll be probably by the end of this week we'll have something like 5 ebooks published about songwriting. So it's been going well.
It's incredible. I think it's astounding the amount of content you're churning out. But I know you had a bunch of it either written or already in your head beforehand. So I think we better point out to listeners that when I say scribbling, you haven't been old school with ink and paper.
It's computer-based. I've heard of these things. Apparently there's this thing called the internet, Carl. But yes, banging away on a keyboard, putting down lots of guff about songwriting. So, as you say, I've had a lot of stuff in my brain. As you would know over the years, I'm not shy about talking about stuff that I'm passionate about. And really, it was just a process of putting that stuff, you know, into collective chunks, organizing them in such a way that, you know, kind of made sense. And then what we're doing now is sending them out into the wide world as little, you know, e-books off to find some friends and hopefully, you know, inform and delight and prod and push and everything else that an interesting book should do to your brain for people that are interested in the same sorts of things. So hopefully that's where we're headed with this stuff.
Yeah, and it's at the time of this recording, there's four published already? And
three up, four probably tomorrow will be number four, and probably by the end of the week, number five. So it's been a pretty fruitful couple of months and pretty intense, but, yeah, very interesting and very satisfying.
That might be a lawnmower. Maybe I'll close the window. Thought it was a motorbike.
That's not the sea.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is, I do remember years ago, my brother being in Sydney for a visit, and I can't remember what the conversation was about, but I imagine it was about movies or music. And I remember my brother Ollie saying to you, "Man, people want to hear this stuff. You need to be sharing this information. Yeah. What are you doing with it?" And I don't know if he had some kind of entrepreneurial idea for you at the time, but I think that he was genuinely enthused by what you were able to just roll out in general conversation. And I'm really enjoying the results as well. As a crazy songwriter who needs, you know, constant fuel for my songs and for the things I want to share as well. It's just amazing to read the things that you collect and then put them into context like this is even better.
I think so. I mean, what we've kind of come to is probably a process of identifying information and then offering it in a format that's clear and concise and enjoyable for people. So that's, I think ultimately that's where you and I both agree. We need to condense and find ways of communicating, you know, things that we love about songwriting, and there's so much to love about it, and there's so much of it out there. It can be a bit of a minefield. It can be, you know, it's a great journey to be on to find out stuff. But, you know, as someone a little bit older than you, as I am, I've been through lots of different eras, and, you know, I've got a brain that retains information, and I've got a passion for it, so it doesn't seem to me incongruous to want to share it in that way. So, yeah, while I do ramble on a bit incessantly at times, it's it's from a deep desire to want people to know the dimension of that, of what they're interested in and where they can maybe find ways to satiate their own interest, you know. So.
Yeah, well, if you don't mind me asking, so I've been I found myself through a sequence of events and varying circumstances, I found myself sharing thoughts on songwriting and ideas and whatever I might call them, whatever I might label them. But I wanted to put myself in a space to be able to inspire others. And I think that I wanted to do that because throughout the years, whenever I have been fortunate enough to be in a position where I've inspired others to create something, which really excites me, it's a great feeling. Mm. And I don't want to keep all that information to myself. Mm. I know that it falls on the ears of the listeners in different ways every time.
Sure.
And some will be inspired one day, some will be inspired in other ways on other days. And maybe it's not right for some people.
Look, to me, it's just an expansion of the process of communication. You know, you can communicate with a song because that's essentially what it is, to me anyway. A song is a communication. And, you know, like any conversation with someone, some conversations are more interesting or more informative or, you know, or have different levels to them than others.
Some you just want to be rescued from.
Man, you betcha. So, and some songs I've wanted to be rescued from many times over the years. You know, so it is a complete and utter expression of humanity. It's that's And songs can either be gloriously silly or gloriously transcendent, you know, from all points in between. I mean, it runs the gamut of life. And so to be interested in songwriting is to be interested in life. I think that's... So it really, you know, to me it's incongruous that people want to sit in a room and write, you know, navel-gazing treatises of pain and regret, and that's it. I mean, the only reason you would ever want to write about pain and regret, which is a very legitimate thing to want to write about, that's fine. But man, I would think then you'd want to share it to say, look, here's some insights I have into this. And even if it's a little confronting or a little hard to listen to, which the best songs about pain and regret are, because you empathise with the writer, then yeah, that's to me, you're still communicating. You know, you can communicate great joy, you can communicate pain, but in the end, it's a conversation about understanding, because the more you know, the more equipped you are to deal with the time you're going to be in pain. So music has an incredible capacity to be able to inform, delight, to do all of these things, to soothe, to calm, to relax, to heal. I mean, music is a very, mystical force in some ways. And this is coming from someone, as you know, who's not particularly mystical. My brain just doesn't work like that. But I understand, the transcendent experiences I've had have either been to do with family or relationships, obviously, but certainly music and great art can evoke the same kind of transcendence that other people find in, you know, spirituality or whatever.
I think it's really interesting to start thinking about it like that. And I was just trying to remember, as you were saying that, like what the evolution of that is in us from an early age. Like I do remember the first record I really wanted and I got my mum to buy me, and it was when I was a kid in Edinburgh, and it was a 70s disco thing. And you know, that makes a lot of sense, because that's what was going around. I was born in 71, and that was what was on the radio, and I heard it and it was catchy.
Great.
It did something to me. I was probably an awesome little dancer at the time. I can only imagine. And then I remember the next stages of that, where I was learning instruments and what that did for me. And then I learned it. And then I remember exercises in composition and what joy that brought me. And that's probably the most interesting one for me, because that's when you start talking about how does that happen? Yeah. The magic, what that feels like.
Yeah.
And then later on in life, like now, for example, just to jump forward a bunch of years, what I get from endlessly going out on a mission to find new things that excite me about music, but also from coming across it, is it just fulfills my desire to feel, I want to be inspired every day. I've got that in me that I want to be excited by either songwriting from other folks or for my own craft, for my own art, for my own way of expressing myself. Yeah. And I was just thinking about, as you were saying that, I was going, well, it does all those things. Mm. I mean, we could replace songwriting with art for this conversation. Mm. But because it's what we do is songwriting, it fits perfectly.
Yeah.
And I know that right now with what I'm getting to read, with what you're bringing with these books, is that it's fulfilling something in me where I'm getting an education, historically about... Mm. You know, the events that surrounded these amazing songs or these songs that have stood the test of time. Mm. Not only that, I'm getting inspired because you also break down the constructs of the songs. And that to me is also an education, because I don't sort of often look into the most amazing songs like that. I just go, whoa, I love it because the lyrics
Because it does blow something me away to me. It takes me on a journey. I mean, that's right. You know, the best songs take you on a journey. They take you out of what you're in. Your brain just goes somewhere else for 3 minutes or whatever. And that's the incredible power of music. Whenever I hear a song that's particularly, you know, rooted in the past that I've heard, it takes me to that place completely. Well, I mean, we spoke a little earlier off mic about how a song can do that, or what it means to you. And I can hear just the most innocuous pop song and all of a sudden I'm a 14-year-old helping my dad out in the garden, you know, because I remember hearing it on the radio that he would have all the time. And it's like, I might not have heard that song in 10 years, in 15 years, but,
yeah,
you know, all of a sudden the years vanish and you're just, you know, completely in that space in a tiny suburb of a town, you know, on the end of the world in Hobart, going, I'm in the front yard of someone's garden helping my dad do the gardening. How'd that happen?
Mm.
Then all of a sudden I'm back in Sydney in, you know, 2014 going, all right.
Yeah, in the same way that a scent or perfume can stand you still and transport you somewhere. Yeah. My kids now, they love Sgt. Pepper's and have done for a few years. But it's amazing because I introduced them to it, obviously.
Yeah.
And then what Sgt. Pepper's does for me is I have memories of basically my brother blasting it, which is how I got into the Beatles, and me telling him, turn his music down.
Turn your music down, Paul.
So he was just blasting Sgt. Pepper's over and over.
And now you said that, and all of a sudden, and bizarrely, I'm in John Tolman's sister's bedroom.
Should we edit this part?
This is fine. This is fine. I must have been 10 years old. It's probably 1968 or something, 69. And John Tolman has the record out of his sister's copy of Sgt. Pepper's, and we're reading the words, which is something you never do. Now, he's a kid I went to primary school with up the road in Claremont, and you saying that about Sgt. Pepper's that's gone straight to my head, and I've gone, man, I remember where I was when I first came to grips with that album,
yeah,
and how different it was from whatever else was around. I didn't understand it, had no idea about what the words, but we're listening to, you know, Fixing a Hole or something, and it's like, it's doing something to a 10-year-old's brain, but I had no idea what.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all information and experience. And John played the piano, funnily enough, this is a little side note. And he would never come out to play football. And I was going, you come out to play football, man. What's going on, you know? He said, I have to do piano lessons. I thought, oh, that sucks, you know. And then years later...
Sounds like me as a child.
Yeah, exactly. I actually didn't see him for probably 8, 10, 9 years. And he moved out of the area, went to different schools. We never went to the same high school for long. His parents moved, and I saw him when we're all doing university years, and I'd got a job by then and had a band, and John was there as a university student while I was playing in the band, and he's going, I didn't know you play. I said, well, you play, come up and have a jam with us. Now I stopped, man, I regret it. You know, just what a pity. So all of those years where he wasn't coming out to play football didn't end up with anything that he could take away from it anyway, because he eventually gave up piano. And here I was, who hated music, or not hated it, but had no exposure to lessons or playing. And I'm playing in the band, going, come on up.
And there you live and breathe it.
Bizarre, yeah, just how it goes.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things you said, I like it. We'll get on to the topics of the book in a minute, but I just, as you were saying that as well, I think that if I put my mind to it, I could probably list maybe 10 albums that I would jump off the bus in Oxford Street in London, and it was Christmas time, snowing, you're trying to get through all the people, waiting for about 20 minutes to cross the road in the crowds. So everyone's touching you, because that's what they do when you're trying to cross the road. You're just squashed up against everyone else's shoulders, and I'm not going to mention the tubes. But I used to, you know, stop in at HMV or Virgin and buy albums that I really wanted, because maybe when they used to release a few singles before they released the album. And then we'd anticipate the album, and because we liked what we'd heard so far, and we'd go and put all our trust in getting the album. And I could probably, if I thought about it, I could sit down and list maybe 10 records that I would go home and listen to as soon as I got home on the tube train, and put the headphones on, have the booklet, reading everything in the booklet, listening to the whole album, maybe stopping for dinner, maybe not. But I just think that in a lot of ways those days are gone. I know that I haven't had the anticipation for a new album like that for many years now.
Yeah, different ways of consuming stuff. I mean, the good thing is the songs are still there. I mean, either the historical backlog of great songs, which, you know, we're looking at, but also new songs. So there are some great new songs around. The trick now is to find the device that enables you to sort through them, and that's kind of why we're doing what we're doing, I think, is we want to be an aid to people navigating those, you know, endless seas of what's on offer now.
Well, it is endless. There's so much to explore. And I'm a massive music enthusiast, and great songs especially. And in the last few months, I've been enlightened to some other gems that I might not have otherwise found. That's what I love about these as well.
Well, it's the same, you know. And again, I think we've spoken about this, but, you know, it's no one person knows everything, which may be stating the obvious. But in music, yep, I don't know every great song that's ever been written. I know many, many, many. I don't know every great band that's around now, but I know plenty. So, you know, I'm attracted to certain things. I seek out certain things. I have found a lot of stuff. So, you know, I think in the same way that you've got a lot to share on your side of your approach to songwriting, there's also something to be said for filling in an historical perspective for people to say, look, if you like this kind of approach, if you share this philosophy of songwriting, then here are some leads for you to go, you know, you might not have thought of before. You might not have occurred to you to find these kinds of writers, these kinds of bands, this kind of line to go down. But if you do, man, there's plenty for you to find down that way. And, you know, so I think all we're doing is kind of putting a few little signposts up by doing this, encouraging people that are already interested in songwriting, as we are, and going, yes, there are ways and means to find and negotiate what are very intricate webs of, you know, paths on a map that looks like, you know, just a mess of spaghetti. But all we're trying to do is highlight a few of those strands to say, look, try this one. I think you'll like it. I think you'll find something down here that will make the journey worthwhile.
Definitely. I think the, excuse me, I think the, in general conversation, when you're talking to someone who's enthusiastic about songwriting also, they might say one thing that makes you want to pick up your guitar or that just inspires you, and the next day you think about it and you're riding some kind of wave that has injected you with some kind of inspiration. What I think I'm getting from, because I'm living this at the moment, because we're reading parts of them every day and putting them together, is I think it's just providing me with an endless well, and different in different ways. For, you know, from Nick Lowe to Kate Bush, I'm finding something new, and that's what I think we need. Is we need to be living and breathing it to be ready for that mystical thing that happens during our process.
You never know. What started this, I guess, was just, this notion of putting down in coherent ways information. And as I open up, so we started this, let's go back to the beginning. The first book we've published is, and I've called them beginnings for the first series of books, because I wanted to look at the beginnings of the great songwriters, you know, of people that I rate. So volume one, I started with, who else? Lennon and McCartney and Bob Dylan. So beginnings volume one is their first three albums, which was, it took them all of 18 months, more or less, for the pair of them, certainly under 2 years, for these two producers of great songs to kick off their careers. So three albums, under 2 years, and both side, you know, either side of the Atlantic, and both game-changing constructs. So I thought, well, that's a good place to start with beginnings. And the first quote that I put in the introduction, I'm just looking at it now, was Sir Isaac Newton's, which is, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's, in music's not like, while art is mystical and it is inexplicable at some areas, it's also transferable and understandable in that most writers and most performers are going to be imitating their idols or their inspirations to start with, and then they will find their own voice. And that's a given. No one picks up a pen and writes Moby Dick. Or, you know, it takes some journey towards that to find your own voice as a writer. No one picks up a pen and writes, I want to hold your hand. Those guys started out by imitating their rhythm and blues idols from the States. They just wanted to play that music. they loved harmony singers, so they put some Everly Brothers in on top of it, and all of a sudden you've got this kind of very rhythmic, very raucous undertone of rhythm and blues in the backing track, and this really sweet harmony laden vocal up the top, you know. So that was different. They found their own voice, translated it, and then everyone went, wow, I like that, and it changed, you know, how things were done. Dylan only ever wanted to play Woody Guthrie songs, which is amazing when you think about it, because by the time I came to Dylan, and certainly by the time you came to him, he was, you know, the preeminent voice in modern songwriting to a degree, certainly for so intelligent, literate, poetic, all of that stuff. Bob was the man, and understandably so, but he only wanted to play Woody Guthrie songs. He thought, bizarrely, and you read about this in Chronicles, he thought all the good songs were written. Why would he write a song? It didn't even occur to him until he went to Greenwich Village and, you know, as a failed rock and roller, folk music was the music of the day. He jumped in and he said, you know, I had to make it somehow. This was kind of my last chance because rock and roll didn't work out. He was just like most kids, into Elvis and wanted to be a rock and roller. But by the time he got to Greenwich Village, it was folk music, so he tried out folk. He loved Woody Guthrie, so he's doing that. And then a guy called Rambling Jack Elliott was writing songs. And he listened to a couple of his songs and thought, wow, Woody hasn't written all the good ones. In fact, there's still good ones being written. In fact, maybe I could write a few. Bizarrely, he starts writing. And then sooner or later, he, you know, and again, I didn't realise how much he took from the folk tradition and how many of his early melodies were certainly based on or just lifted completely note for note from old traditional folk songs, which was very common at the time. But the music industry, which was run by Tin Pan Alley, didn't really promote that kind of side of it. So for all intents and purposes, people thought that Dylan wrote the melody to Blowing in the Wind. But he didn't. He took it from a very old folk song. And with many of his early songs, that was the case for the first couple of albums. But then when the Beatles came along and he was really energised by what they had to do, incredibly. So there's this dialogue between Bob and the Beatles that kind of invests poetry and intelligence into their take on music and energy and verve into his, for with, you know, so he went out and got a guitar band. And
isn't that amazing?
You know, and he made an album called Bringing It All Back Home, because he, in his mind, the Beatles were bringing rock and roll back to the home of rock and roll, which is America. So they were bringing it all back home. So he went, wow, I need to get in on this. And he'd moved on from folk music very quickly.
Do you think that at the time, because I'm wondering if, you know, they were all too cocky and smart and living the dream. Do you think that at the time they felt like pioneers, or do you think they felt like, you know, most people feel when they're on that kind of ride that one day someone's going to pull back the curtain and
I think, you know, very much there's all those insecurities they both had, you know, on both sides of the musical spectrum. I thought most artists go through an early phase of thinking, how am I getting away with this? Because everyone stays in awe of your influences. The Beatles, you know, were in awe of Little Richard. Presley had them speechless. In fact, when they met Presley, he said to them, if you're just going to sit there and stare at me, I'm going to bed. You know, so he met them one night in Hollywood, where he's there making one of his naff movies, and they were just, you know, gobsmacked. So, you know, you stay in awe of those. Dylan went to visit Woody Guthrie famously in his hospital bed, paying homage to his idol. So, you know, you don't rate yourself at that. No matter, I think, you know, unless you really got an inordinate amount of ego, and plenty of artists have, most people that are thinking about it think that, you know, I'm just trying to do something that's respectful to the people that I like, really, that sort of stands up against that. If I can do that, I'll be happy. But then when people start, you know, initially saying, yeah, this is great or that's great, and, you know, you should have a voice in your head saying, well, time will tell. I'll work as well as I can. And, you know, the only test for a lot of this stuff, which I think is one that I apply, is the test of time. That's but the test.
Are any of us content enough and assured enough every day to actually say that to ourselves and mean it?
Hard to know. It's a question. It's a conundrum. But ultimately, all you can do is, I think, is inform yourself to the best of your ability to what you need to fuel yourself as an artist. Whatever that is. If it's inspiration that you find from poetry, people read literature, people watch films, people, you know, just get in.
People need a walk in the countryside. People need to be by the ocean.
Get in amongst it.
Yep.
Get in it. That's, you know, life is not walled up inside your bedroom with video games, or, you know, that's only part of it.
Well, I think it changes as well. Like, I go through phases of needing to get right into a good book, or needing to get inspiration from other songwriters. I go through months of not listening to the radio sometimes, because I find it can be a bad influence.
Yep.
And, or maybe not necessarily a bad influence at those times, but a distraction. So I'd rather just make the art I'm making,
yep,
rather than listen to anyone else's. That kind of thing.
I think a lot of artists, once they've been in it for a long time, don't necessarily do the things that they used to do to find inspiration. You know, when you're young and you're listening to stuff, you know, you just absorb what's around you. You absorb it on the telly, you absorb it in the radio, you absorb it on the net, whatever it is that's coming through, you absorb it. You don't question it. You just go with it.
You just reminded me of that great interview, which I couldn't find a little while back when I looked for it, with it was at Lollapalooza with Santana and Dylan backstage. And the reporter asked Bob who he's been listening to recently. And this was like
Lead Belly
10 years ago. And he said something like, bizarrely, he said Manic Street Preachers.
Okay.
But then he said, is there anyone else you think is good? And he said, oh, the Wallflowers.
The Wallflowers, yeah, that's right. Give the sun a plug.
And then a few years later, and is it Love and Theft, where he mentions Alicia Keys in the first few lines of the album?
Yeah. He's always been, you know, I think Steve Earle told that great story of him when, you know, Steve Earle's great quote was, I'll say that Townes Van Zandt's the greatest songwriter ever, and, you know, I'll stand up on Bob Dylan's coffee table in my cowboy boots and say that if I have to. And, you know, he wondered whether Bob had seen that. And then Bob, he supported Bob not long after on some show. And Bob didn't say a word to him. But he opened up the show with Lefty and Pancho.
Is that right?
A Townes Van Zandt song. So he knew. But, and Earl just went, he got me. He didn't have to say anything. That's how his mind worked.
And
we're talking about Dylan. Volume one is Beginnings. And so the next, for those writers, I need to write a series of books, you know, that e-books that tells their story. So I've only scratched the surface with Beginnings Volume one. Then Beginnings Volume two, I started with another couple of iconic pairs. That's Paul Simon and Brian Wilson. And then I will move towards a different phase for them as well. I think the next volumes will be called Prime Time. And that'll be down the track a bit. But talking about Dylan with Blood on the Tracks is I've used one of the songs in a collection of songs for the fourth and fifth books that we're putting out. So they're essentially we've nailed down great songs by great songwriters. As you would know, it was originally going to be 50 great songs, 50 great songwriters, but that was turning into such an unwieldy beast for an ebook. It was just getting to be too big. So we thought, well, 25 is probably too little and 50 is too many. So what's in the middle? I thought, you know, 30 doesn't cut it. 35's a bit naff. 33, we'll go with 33 because it's got all those overtones of the vinyl years for all of us that are of a certain vintage. So the books will be 33 great songs, 33 great songwriters. And in one of the first volumes, I think it's in volume one, I look at Bob Dylan. And we've got from Blood on the Tracks, I'm just going to bring it up here on my pad. We've got Tangled Up in Blue. Actually, it must be in volume... Yeah, here it is, volume one. So Isn't that the sound of pages turning? Don't exist when you've got an iPad.
Swiping.
And an ebook, yeah, swiping. So I remember on this, this is kind of, we're talking about inspiration and stuff, Bob giving a nod to the wallflowers, as you said, which is funny here because this whole story, when you look through The Blood on the Tracks, which is, to me, it's his best album, and I'll stand up on Steve Earle's coffee table and say that, but... surprisingly, Dylan had gone through a lot of changes by the time he got to 74. He'd been through the self-portrait phase, which really threw people for a loop. You know, he'd done the a lot with the band. He'd done Planet Waves.
Planet Waves, which is fantastic.
Great records. But he was definitely in a changing mood, and he went back to Greenwich Village. So this is 10 years after his great triumphs there, and he moved back there to live. So he's not living in Woodstock, he's moved back to New York City. He studied with a painter, so this is his way to infuse his art. So he knew he was a bit stagnant, I think, and knew he needed something to refresh himself, but it created problems in his marriage. So I'll just read you a little bit from what I've written here. So in 1975, it says, after some years in the creative wilderness, Bob Dylan found his way back to top form after the curious turns of Self-Portrait and Planet Waves. Albums equally mischievous and mysterious in large part. In 1974, Bob had moved back to Greenwich Village, the site of his initial triumphs in the early 60s, and there he immersed himself in the scene again. Bob also became a student again with renowned art teacher Norman Rayburn, a man who, he said, taught me to do consciously what I used to do unconsciously. So that's interesting, and very Bob, you know. So it says, Bob, it goes on, Dylan studied with him intently for 2 months, which is a long time, cogitating on truth and love and beauty, in Bob's words. However, there were unexpected consequences. Bob said of the experience in 1978, so this is 4 years later, he said, needless to say, it changed me. I went home after that, and my wife didn't understand me ever since that day. That's when our marriage started breaking up. She never knew what I was talking about and what I was thinking about, and I couldn't possibly explain it. And you're going, wow. And so Blood on the Tracks became the breakup album because he's gone back to look at his art, to look at what really enthused him, and to find his music again after a few odd years of being creatively up and down. And painting has done it. This guy's inspired him. He said later as well.
I'm just imagining him after spending 2 months with Norman Rayburn, just going back and going, "You just don't understand me anymore, baby."
Wow.
We're going in different directions here.
So he says of Tangled Up in Blue, then it says, it was another one of those things where I was trying to do something that I didn't think had ever been done before, in terms of trying to tell a story and be a present character in it without it being some kind of fake, sappy, attempted tearjerker. So this is this whole Tangled Up in Blue, which is, just goes on and on forever, but it's just this magic, mesmerizing kind of story.
Yeah, it's far from a fake.
Yeah, so happy. He goes here in terms of trying to tell a story without being a tearjerker. He says, I was trying to be somebody in the present time while conjuring up a lot of past images. I was trying to do it in a conscious way. I used to be able to do it in an unconscious way, but I just wasn't into that way anymore. I wanted to defy time, so the tale took place in the present and the past at the same time, right? And then he says, when you see a painting, you can see any part of it or see all of it together. I wanted that song to be like a painting. So there, all of a sudden, he's pulled together that whole idea of what Norman Rayburn was teaching him about subconscious versus unconscious. And so he's needed to think, this is a man who's reinvented music a couple of times by that stage, and yet he's still thirsty for finding a way to understand his art.
Yeah, he wants to deconstruct it some more for himself.
Correct. So that wasn't to do with fashion. It wasn't to do with, I need a hit. It was nothing to do with that. It was like, where is the muse taking me? I've hit a dead end here. I've done all that. I need something different. Paul Simon, incredibly, which is in volume 2, I think we put American Tune. So for me, he's one of the great writers of all time. He gets to the end of the 60s, and so in Beginnings Volume 2, which is Paul Simon and Brian Wilson, it concentrates on just the first phase of Paul's career, which is in Simon and Garfunkel, and it peaks with Bridge Over Troubled Waters. So they had their most successful album as their last album, and they split up directly after it. They were the biggest duo in history, in pop history, and they split up on that album. And it's number one everywhere. It's selling millions of copies. It's number one all around the world. The single, the title track, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, is number one single all over the world. And what does Paul Simon do? He goes back to a songwriting composition class at Columbia University. He's sitting down with guys who are 18, 19, 20, whatever. He's sitting down there. He's all of, you know, 30, I suppose, or maybe not quite. He's sitting there studying composition. He's
number one in the charts.
And he's number one in the guys. So you're sitting next to a guy who's sold millions of records. He's already written Sounds of Silence and America and Mrs. Robinson and Bridge Over Troubled Waters. And he's sitting next to you learning about songwriting. And you're going, man, yeah, that's, you know, that, again, that's, it speaks volumes. And now he, soon after, the tune that we've got in volume two that we look at is American Tune. And it's based on a Bach classical piece. And you hear the melody in it, and it's quite complex and beautiful and the way it unfolds, but he's taken it from Bach, put this absurdly poetic overlay that speaks to the American dream and the decay of the American dream. It's, you know, it's gorgeous, but it's not three folk chords, you know, well, 1, 4, and 5, three folk chords. It's very complex, you know, chromatically ascending, descending, fugue of some sort, and it's just stunning. But it, would he have written that if he hadn't gone to Columbia and started thinking about composition in that way?
If he hadn't already had a number one and didn't know what to do with himself next.
All of that stuff. So there are...
I was reading somewhere recently about that. I mean, it's was it David Byrne and... Both David Byrne and Peter Gabriel, they took a break. And I think Peter Gabriel went off and focused on his charity.
Yeah.
And David Byrne went off and became an author. And,
sure.
You know. And these guys at the peak of their career.
You would think, yeah, but it's...
It wasn't about just coming up with something next. It was about them...
And when it's just about coming up with something next, you can almost guarantee that the something next is going to be a rehash of something that was.
Yeah, and they were smart enough to... I mean, like Dylan went and hung out with Norman Rayburn.
You can keep going and doing the same thing. It's if you do that, like any artist, it's the law of diminishing returns, I think. My favourite filmmaker, you know, and as you know, I write a bit on film, is a guy called Jean Renoir. He's, to me, the greatest director in the history of film. And his father was Pierre-Auguste Renoir, and he was one of the great French painters of the last part of the 19th, the early part of the 20th.
Pierre-Auguste.
Yeah, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, who was a great painter. Lovely little painter. Pete was, you know, Pierre. And I think there's a new French film that was up for Academy Award, which I haven't seen yet, but it details the late period of Auguste's obsession with a young woman when he was in his 70s. And Jean had just come back from the war where he was a flyer. He was shot down and injured, and he comes back to stay with his dad. And I think they both have it off with this young girl. But that's another story. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, talking about his art as a director, and obviously being the son of the most famous painter, you know, French painter, one of the most famous ever, he said he learned from his father. You know, he said that if an artist just paints from memory, you're doomed to repeat yourself. He said, if I paint a leaf, there's only so many variations my mind will come up with. He said, whereas nature offers me an infinite variation. So you go out and find, you know, a leaf and you paint it, because you know that nature will blow you away at every point to something that you can come up with in your own mind.
So we'll leave part one of that chat there, friends. I know that you're going to need some time to absorb some of that, and I'll be back at you with part two of this conversation very soon. That'll be episode 16, and I'm going to try and upload that within a week from you hearing this. So if you're listening to this in the future, then just if you go to your iTunes page or Stitcher or wherever you get the podcast from, then just click on episode 15 or 16 for both of these. Thanks so much for being here. It means the world to me that people keep coming to this podcast. The downloads are going crazy, and I never imagined when I started this that it'd be thousands and thousands of people around the world listen to my thoughts and tips on songwriting, and just, you know, things like me talking to great friends who I find inspirational, And I hope to, well, I don't hope to, I promise I'm going to continue to bring as much of this stuff to you for free as I can. My schedule permitting, which at the moment it's been pretty good. I'm squeezing it in, but I think that's because I'm so passionate about it. If you like the show, please share it with your friends. Give them the heads up that they'll get something from it as well. And always grateful for any iTunes reviews. It really helps the show get ranked. And I'll give you a shout out on the podcast if you leave us a little review there as well. It's been fun mentioning the wacky handles that people use for their iTunes reviews. So from the clifftops of Sydney, thanks again for being here, and I'll see you in the next episode. All the best.